You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we talk about today's Supreme Court decision not to hear challenges to state assault weapons bans. First, listening to politicians, reading the news, or chatting with friends and neighbors, it may seem like we're in a time of unprecedented doom and gloom. But looking at the data, the United States is in better shape now and moving, for the most part, in positive directions. So why aren't we feeling better about life? Greg Easterbrook is a contributing editor of The Atlantic. He's the author of The Progress Paradox, How Life Gets Better While People Feel Worse, and a recent New York Times opinion piece, When Did Optimism Become Uncool? Greg, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Judith.
Well, let's start with that premise that things are not nearly as bad as we think they are. What would you point to? Maybe start with the economy.
Well, think about what we hear in public debate, Donald Trump saying the country is going to hell and so on. Then look at the data. Economically, unemployment is unusually low in historic terms and almost as low as it was during what we now think of as the golden age in the late 1990s. Growth is mild, but still we've had five straight years of expanding GDP and expanding jobs. Living standards have never been higher. The secondary indicators of living standards are all positive. Longevity is increasing. Most diseases are declining. Most forms of pollution are declining. Crime is in a long-term cycle of decline. Almost everything that you can measure objectively about the sociological condition of the country is in the best shape that it's ever been in. And yet we're all so negative about the country's situation.
Right. You reference in your New York Times piece an April Gallup poll that found that only slightly over one quarter of Americans call themselves satisfied with, quote, the way things are going in the United States. So how do you explain that disconnect?
Well, I think social science research shows that a lot of what people's feelings of life satisfaction and similar, whatever touchy-feely way you want to use to describe it, a lot of people's feelings about this are not so much concerned with their current objective condition, but what they expect will happen next. So if your current condition is a difficult one, but you think that life is going to get better 5 years from now, you feel pretty good. Whereas if your current condition is reasonably good, but you think that life is arcing downward, then you express the kind of negative feelings that we see in society today. The Gallup poll that you mentioned, Judith, the last time it showed that a majority of Americans thought the country was headed in a positive direction was 12 years ago in the first term of the younger President Bush. So we've had 12 straight years where Americans think things are about to get worse. It hasn't happened. I can't guarantee you that it will never happen, but the expected getting worse of the country hasn't occurred. In general, not everything, of course, but in general, most things continue to improve. But we seem to be convinced that things are just about to get worse, and I think that has a lot to do with the mood of the country.
So one statistic that you quote that I think really sums up that disconnect between the reality of life today and perceptions is that even taking into account September 11th, an American is five times more likely to be hit by lightning than to be killed by a terrorist. But yet terrorism is a very real, palpable fear, and the battle against it is a high priority for many Americans. So just looking at that one statistic, where does the idea of terrorism looming large over our daily lives come from? How does it have that staying power?
Well, terrorism is horrible. What happened in Orlando, 49 people gunned down. Your mind can't get around what a horrible thought that is. Not just something that's morally wrong and that threatens the country, and they'll just try to imagine what that scene must have been like. And if you counter that by saying, but the odds of this happening to me are far less than one in a million, that in that case you're juxtaposing emotion versus logic, and emotion is always going to win. But I think one reason that there are two reasons that we focus so much on terrorism. One is that politicians talk about it endlessly, for good or ill. It's a favorite topic of politicians. And secondly, we live in a news cycle world that's dominated by cable networks and social networks, both of which drastically exaggerate anything wrong. They oversell anger. They create the impression that what's going on all around the world every day is Orlando after Orlando, when in fact, right now, not just for the United States, but for the whole world, any resident anywhere in the world, your chances of dying by violence right now are the lowest they've been in human history, and they are noticeably lower than they were even just 25 years ago.
And you say in your New York Times opinion piece, going back to those political messages that then the 24-hour news cycle picks up and repeats and repeats and repeats, you say this election season, the impending apocalypse has been issue number one for presidential aspirants on both sides. Let's start with the Republicans. What messages were they putting out when the field was still crowded with contenders and they were trying to jockey for position?
Well, it wasn't just saying that Donald Trump saying that the country's going to hell, and Trump constantly says we're losing all the time. I don't know what country he's talking about because all the rest of the world thinks that we're winning all the time. But Ted Cruz said the United States is near an abyss. Now, this is technically true since there is a physical abyss in the Gulf of Mexico, but he meant that the country was going to fall into some sort of biblical abyss. Marco Rubio, when he was still in the race, said, I don't know if the United States has 4 years left before it ceases to exist. Lindsey Graham, when he was running for president, said that the world is falling to pieces. You look out the window and you don't see any evidence of this, but it makes a good political appeal because politicians, especially at the early stage when they're seeking donations, they're looking for zealous followers who are willing to provide both time and money. And creating a sense that there's some sort of apocalypse in play. And as the very wise Warren Buffett says, politicians always want to create that sense because then you need to give power and money to politicians. If things are basically fine, you can trust your community to take care of it. I think that was a big factor in the Republican run-up, but it was not exclusive to Republicans. Bernie Sanders talks about the economy like the world is ending when average people are not completely happy, of course, with their conditions, but have statistically never been better off than they are today.
So you say that, especially when there was this field of 17 contenders, you know, people were trying to kind of out-tough each other on the Republican side. Now that it looks like Donald Trump will be the nominee, or maybe someone will come out of the woodwork at the convention, but looking pretty strong for Donald Trump, is there any chance that he will go away from that very negative, we're in dire straits kind of position, or is that his bread and butter right now?
Well, it sure. Trying to understand the mental processes of Donald Trump is, I think, a losing game for everyone, probably including him. Certainly in the last century, with the exception of during Depression, World War II, and a couple of the dark years of the Cold War, most American national leaders have tried to emphasize an optimistic view of the country's future. And that's certainly what I take. I have three children. I think they've been born at a wonderful time. I think 2016 is the best year ever in the United States. 2017 will be better still. And the easy mental test of it was, seriously, what year in the past would you rather live in than today? But this curious change of nothing but negative rhetoric on the overall larger national political scene, I think it's driven by cable news and social media, where the point that I tried to make in that New York Times piece is that today, if you're an optimist, you're viewed as a Pollyanna. You know that saying, if you don't understand, if you're not upset about the situation, then you don't understand the situation. People who think who take optimistic views are not Pollyannas. It doesn't mean that they deny that there are problems. Of course, there are all kinds of problems. The optimists think the problems can be fixed. And when I look at the United States, I see climate change, inequality, racial tension. There's plenty of problems. But as an optimist, I think we can fix all those problems. And the sort of negative reactionary worldview that's promoted by Trump and also by Bernie Sanders would only take us backwards to a place that we don't want to go.
We're talking with Greg Easterbrook about his recent New York Times opinion piece, When Did Optimism Become Uncool? He's also the author of The Progress Paradox, How Life Gets Better While People Feel Worse. And you've pointed to Bernie Sanders. Hillary Clinton also has had some negative messages out there. And I think you make a really interesting point about liberals and progressives in your opinion piece. You say that their traditional role in U.S. politics has been to be the sunny optimists who are tempered by the more realistic and negative conservatives. And so now the balance between the two that was pretty crucial to U.S. politics has been thrown off. So, Greg, what does it mean now that both parties and all of their wings seem to be squarely in the pessimist camp?
Well, think about the history of this. In Wisconsin, you're in one of the birthplaces of the progressive movement of roughly a century ago. And the progressives of that time, progressive with a capital P, they were the optimists. They thought that life could be made better and the average person could live a much more fulfilling, much better educated life. The conservatives of the time, all their worldview boiled down to the word harumph. They thought the judgment day was coming and trying to improve society was pointless. Well, now the left thinks the judgment day is coming too. Conservatives still think that. Donald Trump is the best expression, but the left thinks that nature's about to collapse and that society is horrible and that the days of Jim Crow are back and we're all going to be starving in the streets. It's a huge bundle of nonsense, but it's a bundle of nonsense that gets people to donate money, and I think that's what underlies a lot of this.
We're talking with Greg Easterbrook right now. He's the author of The Progress Paradox, How Life Gets Better While People Feel Worse, and of a recent New York Times opinion piece, When Did Optimism Become Uncool? And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Would you say that you are generally optimistic or pessimistic about life in the United States right now? Whichever way you feel, where do you think that comes from? Does it match how you would describe yourself as a person generally? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation after this short break here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we talk about the Supreme Court's decision to not hear guns rights advocates' challenges to state bans on assault weapons. Right now, we're continuing the conversation with Greg Easterbrook about the negativity and pessimism of the American public and its political leaders in the face of much evidence that points to reasons for optimism. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Would you say that you're generally pessimistic or optimistic about your own life and the state of the country and the directions it's heading in? Whichever way you feel, where do you think those thoughts and feelings come from? Do you want your political leaders to be more positive, or do you think that their pessimism is warranted? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Greg, I thought it was really interesting that you published your book, The Progress Paradox, How Life Gets Better While People Feel Worse, in 2004. So clearly this is not a new phenomenon.
No, it's not. I was working on that book in the late 90s, actually, and that's when the book came out. So it's now a dozen years ago, and I felt that was a keen factor in American life then, and this was before the term social network existed. And I think it's gotten a stronger grip on American thinking today. There's a number of reasons we can think of. One is the structure of media and how media complaints exist. Another is the sort of balkanization of American politics, the growth of us versus them political movements. And if you want it to be us versus them, you always want them to be horrible, terrible people with nefarious motives who must be stopped. I think it's real interesting when you look at poll data. When pollsters, Gallup and others, and the University of Chicago and so on, when they ask people what they think about the condition of the country, for a decade consistently they've been saying, oh, things are terrible. And then you ask them what's the condition of your own community, the place where you live, the schools, the police, et cetera. They're, oh, things are great in my town. So people think that by pretty big majorities, people think that things that they can see with their own eyes are good, but that the larger world is falling mm-hmm. apart. That's because what's the interpreter of the larger world for most people? It's CNN and Fox News, where there's flashing red and everything is negative and anger is overstated. And in a world of now we're up to almost 7 billion people, in a world of 7 billion people, there will always be something that's burning, exploding, mm-hmm. sinking. And if all you see when you turn on your communications media is horror over whatever's burning or exploding at that moment, you may conclude that everything's burning and exploding. And that was kind of one of the founding insights of that book, The Progress Paradox. And I think to the extent that I was accurate in understanding the national mood, it's gotten worse since.
Let's go to the phones, and Frank in Wausau is up. Hi, Frank.
Hi. I'd like your speaker's thoughts on the $19 trillion debt that's being talked about. That makes me pessimistic, but how do you view it, and if you can speak to that?
Thanks, Frank. And Greg, what would you say?
Well, I have three kids, and when I talk to them, I tell them the long-term things that I worry about for their lifetime. I don't worry about climate change. Climate change is real. It's scientifically proven, but it's also an engineering problem, and Americans are really good at solving engineering problems. So I think climate change can be solved if we do the right things. I worry about developing world poverty a lot because it involves such huge numbers of people. Now, you'd never know this, but all the trend lines are positive. The world, if you take the World Bank figures a quarter of a century ago, 40% of the world lived in extreme destitution. It's now down to 10%, and the global population has increased in that period. But we've still got a billion people in the world living in dire circumstances, and that's changing that as a gigantic project. And I tell my kids I worry about the national debt. We've borrowed without restraint in the last decade, not just in the Obama years, to the last 3 years of the younger George Bush administration, too. Beginning in 2006, if you adjust to current dollars, we've borrowed more money than in all the previous years of our republic combined. And anybody who's run a household knows that you can borrow like crazy for a brief time. You can order champagne when you're at the restaurant. If you just do it for a brief time, it's okay. But if you do it all the time, things fall apart. So I would say probably the biggest threat to two biggest threats to our economy, certainly it's not competition with China. I think that's highly overrated, but I worry about national debt, and it is certainly possible that the Luddites will eventually be proven right and automation will take away too many jobs.
Well, I wonder if that idea about the national debt hanging over us is part of that sense of, you know, it's only downhill from here. Like, we're not seeing in our everyday lives the impact of that huge national debt, but, you know, the it's going to come home to roost eventually.
You know, I almost wish, Judith, that you were right about that. Polling data shows that if you talk to political consultants about why debt isn't a bigger issue in any campaign, they all say, because debt doesn't poll. In other words, voters don't care about it. Mm-hmm. Voters care about, can I get more benefits today? We had last week President Obama saying that even with the Social Security system facing a liquidity crisis pretty soon, he wants to increase benefits because everybody wants higher benefits today. I wish people worried more about debt. It's certainly not an unsolvable problem. It's a problem that can be managed. But it's very ungracious, to put it mildly, of I'm a baby boomer, of our generation to be borrowing all this money and handing the bill to our children.
Let's go back to the phones, and Nick in Eagle River is up. Hi, Nick.
Hi there. And actually, I'm from Eagle River, but my wife and I are driving through beautiful Wisconsin, enjoying your program.
Great. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to express my concerned about the fact that those who benefit, whether it be politicians in the form of votes or sometimes media in the form of sponsorship, that benefit from sensationalism and talking about the negative side and blowing it out of proportion and actually fooling people, as you said earlier, into thinking that our economy is not doing as well as it really is. I think that we really have a sad energy level in this country that tends to draw and feed on negativism. And I think that we need to inspire our children and generations to come with the notion that a positive attitude and looking at where we're doing well. I think we need to have more programs on the good things that are going on around us rather than focusing on all the negative, because we are moving in a positive direction.
Thanks for that call, Nick. And actually, Greg, one of the things I wanted to bring up with you that fits in well with what Nick was just saying is that it seems like one of the draws of Ronald Reagan was his enduring optimism and how positive he felt about the country and what this country is all about. So will there ever be room for another Ronald Reagan in that sense, of being kind of the nation's cheerleader?
Well, I sure wish we had more politicians with Reagan's instinct about that. He wasn't a perfect president, but when he said that it was still morning in America, he was right. I think it's still morning in America today. Maybe it's 11:45 in America, but it's definitely still morning. The country is on an upswing. all the things that are wrong with the country, and there are many things, they're all fixable. There's nothing going on that we can't deal with it, and that if we're willing to work on it. And for me, the key thing that I think was just alluded to by your caller is optimism is the best argument for reform. If you want to deal with climate change, if you want to deal with inequality, deal with them from a standpoint of optimism. We should try to fix these problems because the fix will succeed and the country will become even better. If you're negative, if you think that the world's going to hell, then I guess we really should build walls around the country like Donald Trump thinks. But if you think that, if you think optimistically, if you think that reforms will work, then you want to tackle global warming, racial tension, etc., because 10 years from now, things will be better.
So in your opinion piece in the New York Times, you quote billionaire investor Warren Buffett, who you mentioned earlier, as blaming the negative drumbeat of politics for the fact that, quote, many Americans now believe their children will not live as well as they themselves do. That view is dead wrong. The babies being born in America today are the luckiest crop in history. One of the things that I thought about reading your piece, Greg, is that those babies and children and young people right now are hearing all of the negative views and perspectives that we've been talking about. Is there a risk that they'll be swayed by that as their parents and grandparents seem to be?
Well, since children always reject whatever they're taught, I guess we shouldn't worry about that too much. No, I think kids can see through, kids and young people generally, I mean more young people can see through the nonsense they're being told by the political system. I think that's why there's so much cynicism about politics. But I think it's important, and I hope the young people can make this distinction, to distinguish between thinking that the United States should have 3% GDP growth every year, which was the average from the end of World War II to about 1995. I don't think that's realistic. I don't think it's even necessary to have GDP growth at that level. But it is realistic to think that our society can become ever more tolerant, more open, people will be better educated, crime and disease will keep declining, that the country can keep being a better place.
Greg, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for being with us. Greg Easterbrook is the author of a recent New York Times opinion piece, When Did Optimism Become Uncool? You can find a link to it on the Central Time Facebook page.